Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. David Wiley in this episode. David is a long-time theorist and enthusiast of learning objects and open educational resources. He has worked with Creative Commons and the Open Education Group and is co-founder of Lumen Learning, a leading OER repository. It's my pleasure to be talking with Dr. David Wiley, Chief Academic Officer of Lumen Learning and dedicated advocate of improving education through the use of OER. David's many honours and entrepreneurial activity testify to his forward thinking and authority in online education. David, it's great to be talking with you.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to talk with you as well.
Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Well, I started out as a graduate student in educational technology back in 1998 at Brigham Young University. A lot of my early work was on the topic of learning objects and published a book in that area, a dissertation. And in my early career, I think that's the work that I was primarily known for, my work on learning objects. A couple of years into my career, I started to recognize that there are some issues with learning objects that we were having problem solving. You may remember that the idea of learning objects was to create these small kind of modular components that could be mixed and matched, like Legos. Yeah, so you could create a piece of content one time and then use it in many places. And it turned out that that didn't work as well as we thought it might. And my interest in open source kind of ran together with my work on learning objects. And I realized that the thing that learning objects were missing was an open license. Once you had permission not just to mix and match Legos, but if you could change the color of the Lego and change it from a 3 to a 4, and if you could make those adjustments to it, then that could unlock a lot of the potential that we all saw in learning objects originally. And so the majority of my career has really been spent in open educational resources.
Great. Yeah, I remember the debates taking place. Would have been the 1990s, was it? Was it that early? About learning objects and how they might be formulated?
Yeah, late 90s. There's a lot of arguing over definitions. There's a lot of arguing over metadata standards. There's a lot of arguing over, you know, whether or not they could be automatically selected and combined by an algorithm into something that would be instructionally meaningful. Yeah, lots of debates back in the day.
So how far do you think we've come on that, David? Have we solved those problems that existed all those years ago?
Yeah, we've certainly solved the problems of reusable educational content. Open educational resources has done that for sure. Now I can have kind of an arbitrarily sized piece of learning content, and I can take it and I can adapt it to meet my needs. And in fact, the biggest problem that we had, or one of the biggest problems that we had in the days of learning objects, was a scope or a size problem. What was the right size of a learning object for it to be big enough to be useful, but small enough that it could still be reused in a wide variety of contexts? And in the context of open educational resources now, I can take an entire course. And even though that seems like it's far too big to reuse in many contexts, if all of the content in that course is openly licensed, then I can pull out just the parts that I need, and I can choose whether I want a whole chapter, whether I want a module, whether I just want a couple of paragraphs, whether I just want that single image. And it doesn't put so much stress and emphasis on the original designer to think about what's the right level at which to chunk these things. I can provide access to the entire learning experience as a whole unit in a way that kind of coheres and makes sense. But then that open license gives you permission to take it apart in any way that suits your kind of local demand and need. So I would say absolutely the idea of OER has solved that problem. And it hasn't gotten us any closer to a place where we could write an algorithm that could go into a database of, you know, a million pieces of learning content, assemble them on the fly, and make something meaningful out of them, though. I don't know that we're ever going to make a lot of progress on that.
Right. Actually, coming back to that, the thought of taking an open education course and making use of different parts of it, does that predicate the entire course consisting of OER? So if you were to include some proprietary or third-party licensed resources within that course, you'd be quite limited, wouldn't you, in terms of what you could reuse and pull out?
Yeah, and you'd also be limited in terms of what you could share. You know, if I created a course that, for the third week, I decided to use all proprietary content, And then I went to share that course online so that you could come and find it. There'd just be a giant hole in week three, because obviously I can't share that copyrighted material out in a public-facing way. All that you would see is 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, because all the material that I'd chosen to use there, I might be able to say what it was, like on a syllabus, give you references or, you know, a bibliography. But in terms of you being able to see the content, you won't be able to see it, let alone grab it or do anything with it.
Great. David, can you give us a bit of an overview of Lumen Learning and what your work with them is?
Yeah, so Lumen Learning is, over 7 years old now, and grew out of some grant-funded work. There had been, almost by that point, a decade of philanthropic and government funding that had gone into supporting the creation of open educational resources. But what we were seeing at the time was that even though lots of people were creating and posting open educational resources on their websites, it was very difficult to point to someone who had taken an open educational resource someone else had created and was using it. And the case that we were specifically interested in was what we called displacing adoptions, or in other words, where I've taken an open educational resource and I've put it on my syllabus in the place of the required textbook for the course. So the OER has kind of pushed out whatever proprietary content had been there before. So my friend Kim Thanos and I and a couple of other people collaborated on this grant, which was funded by the Gates Foundation. And the grant proposal basically said, we pinky promise that we will not use any of this funding to create new OER. We're going to spend all of this money bringing together faculty from across multiple institutions and helping them replace their current traditionally copyrighted content with open educational resources. And so the first grant that we received, we did that in 10 courses across 8 colleges and universities in the United States, and then received a follow-on grant to do that with 30 colleges and universities. And at that point, we, Kim and I in particular, both realized that, you know, we were struggling to keep our heads above water with our real jobs and running this grant program on the side, and now making it almost 4 times as big as it had been. You know, we had to kind of choose whether to double down on that work or to let it go. And we both chose to, step away from it. She had been working as a consultant, and of course I'd been working as a faculty member. I was back at Brigham Young University at that time. And so we created Lumen, and the kind of mission and purpose of Lumen is to support faculty in adopting and effectively using open educational resources in place of the traditionally copyrighted material they've been used in the past. And of course, the goals there are to improve access, decrease costs, and improve outcomes for students.
Excellent. How successful has that work been?
Pretty successful, I would say. The number of students that we have supported has essentially doubled every year for the 7 years that we've been doing the work. We supported about 260,000 students last year. And by supported, I mean we had, you know, some kind of relationship with their faculty member, some kind of relationship with them, where they weren't just coming and hitting our website, where, of course, all of the OER is published so that the public can access it freely via our website. But we are providing technology and tools and training and support and other services so that we are actually receiving some revenue for those 260,000 students that then lets us hire people, build new tools, develop new open educational resources, things like that. As of the end of 2019, Lumen Learning was, I think, 43 people on the team. We served about 260,000 students, and we had about 160 million visits to the website of just people from all over the world coming and accessing the OER and making some use of it.
That's brilliant. And of course, recently we have the UNESCO recommendation on OER, which should hopefully extend OER still further. Can you comment on the success of that and what that might mean for Lumen Learning and OER in general?
Well, for OER in general, hopefully it'll go a long way toward kind of raising awareness around the world that there is this thing called OER that exists and that there's a lot of power and potential there. And as governments start to go back and say, okay, we've received this recommendation from UNESCO that we look into this area, potentially develop some policies, do some work internally, and then, you know, in some period of time have to come back and report back to UNESCO on what kinds of activities they've undertaken, hopefully that sparks some energy and effort locally so that more people find out about OER, more people look at it and consider using it in place of traditionally copyrighted materials.
Yeah, excellent. And it looks as though, too, the retain, the fifth R, which I think you're quite concerned about. I understand there's legal advice now that implies that's not a problem.
There are a couple of different ways of thinking about the definition of OER. And we were all really pleased with the definition of OER that was written in the final draft made available to the public, because that final draft included a very clear statement that in order for any particular instructional resource to qualify as an open education resource, it had to be licensed in a way that provided everyone with what we refer to as the 5R permissions, and those are retain, reuse, revise, remix, and redistribute. And retain in particular is pretty important. If you can't make a copy, if you can't retain your own copy of some instructional resource, then you can't make any changes to it. You can't mash it up with other things. You can't revise it. You can't adapt it. And you can't distribute new copies of the thing that you've made if you can never make your own copy in the first place. And so seeing that language of the 5Rs in the final draft was very promising. But unfortunately, in the version of the document that was approved by UNESCO, that 5R language was pulled out, and something considerably weaker was put in its place. It's unclear, kind of from outside of the organization, what happened. You know, who was trading what with whom as the sausage making policy development process went on. That the 5Rs came out and some other language went in, but I think as governments around the world start to try to implement something locally, hopefully they'll call on people who actually have expertise in the area of OER, like people from Creative Commons, for example, who can come in and help them think about licensing and how to ensure that the work they're doing really is open work as opposed to work that's resources that are just available for free. Essentially, the entire internet's available to access for free. The Guardian or CNN or whatever it might be. But just because it's available for free doesn't mean that it's open. It doesn't mean that we have permission to make our own copy and to make changes and do those kinds of things to it. So it's pretty disappointing to see that language get watered down in the final recommendation. But, all the action is an implementation. That's where the rubber hits the road, as we say. So hopefully as countries try to figure out what to do with the OER and start to pull in different organizations to provide technical assistance, they'll get good counsel back along the lines of the 5Rs.
Hopefully. Well, David, it's early 2020, the start of a brand new decade. I'm interested in your observations about online learning and education at the present time and the sorts of things we might be working on as the next decade unfolds.
I'm very, very interested in using technology in order to increase and enhance the kind of connections that we human beings have to each other in the teaching context, whether that's students connecting to their teachers or students connecting to other students. But I think probably one of the greatest missed opportunities, maybe even a tragedy, that you could imagine would be to take this amazing communications technology we have called the internet and then design online learning experiences where students are kind of firewalled off from any communication with any other human beings. They're just downloading PDFs or they're just watching videos and they're sitting in a room by themselves and downloading and uploading and things are graded automatically and they never hear from a teacher. I think there's a huge role for a wide range of kind of advances in technology to play. Like, I think automated grading is terrific and super powerful in as much as if you can create assignments that can be graded automatically, then I can probably practice those an infinite number of times. I can just grade them as soon as I finish with them, give me specific feedback about what I'm misunderstanding. I love those kinds of things and think they ought to be leveraged very highly. But I think they should be leveraged in order to create additional space and time and energy for the humans who are involved in learning to do the things that only humans can do, which is reaching out to each other to express support and empathy and to understand the things that are going on in students' lives and encourage them and inspire them. I think there's a lot of time right now that human teachers spend doing things that could be done more efficiently and more effectively by technology in the online learning context. But for some reason, we sometimes seem kind of unwilling to let go of some of those things. But I know that the experiences I've had as a teacher, the ones that stick with me the most, and as a student as well, are always ones where I'm forming some kind of connection with a teacher or with a student of mine, and building a relationship and supporting them and watching them struggle and seeing them succeed, you know, inspiring them or motivating them when stuff's going on in their life that seems to be trying to pull them off track academically. There's a whole range of those kinds of social, caring interactions that I don't think we've really figured out how to support and how to enable and how to get to yet. So as I look forward, those are some of the things that are the most exciting to me in online learning.
That's an incredibly rich response. I'm very interested to explore that with you, actually. So a course then, the content, to use that dreaded
sure.
term, could be OER, so easily accessible. Students can make free use of it, download it, etc. But what you're talking about here is the added value of the human touch. That there's a wrapper, if you like, of human contact around that. Is that your vision of education going forward?
Yeah, I think my vision of education is one where it becomes increasingly technically sophisticated and increasingly rich in interaction with human beings, and that technical sophistication is being used to kind of pull away the pieces of things that faculty do that don't really add any unique value to the kind of learning exchange that they're having with their students, and freeing up as much time as is possible for them to get to know students and befriend them and support them and motivate and inspire them. I think we need advances in technology that can be time-saving technology, like the automatically grading homework, like I was speaking about before. Even books. Books are really just a way for a person who wants to teach another person something but can't be with them in the same place and time, just record some of that information, and hopefully the person who comes along and picks up the book and reads it doesn't quite get to have a conversation with the author, but in some ways engages in a dialogue with the author. And I think when you look at what happens with instructional materials, if it's possible for me as a faculty member to capture a lot of the explanation and the description, whether that's in video or it's in interactive activities or it's in narrative text, if I can capture all of that and communicate it to you through practice opportunities and whatever else might be in a form that you are able to kind of figure out 90, 95% of it, pick it up, use it effectively. If all the students can get the majority of what we're talking about through these open educational resources, whatever media format they might be in, then instead of me standing up and saying all those things that everyone could have figured out at home, now I can spend my time really just zeroed in on the things that we really need to talk about. Those relationships with other human beings are, I think sacred is the word I want to use. And we have to hold that time. We have to fight for that time to have those interactions and have those conversations and build those relationships and really keep it sacred. And to the extent that we feel that way about it, that means that we are trying to offload everything that can be offloaded so that it happens at home. It happens, you know, by itself. It happens in a place where you can practice and drill and practice. I'm a big supporter of drill and practice in this context, so that that time where human beings can be together and talk to each other, whether it's in a Skype like we're doing now, or it's face-to-face, one-on-one in an office or in a full class setting, so that we can really use that time to talk to each other rather than using it as, like a Broadway show where everybody comes in and sits down and is very quiet while I stand in the front and do my, performance. Whatever it is, and then everyone applauds and leaves. It just seems utterly ridiculous to me that we would spend the precious time that we have together making sure that everyone's being very quiet so that I can do my song and dance.
That's brilliantly articulated. I mean, I think a lot of people looking forward in online education would consider automation and almost a dehumanization of all that we do to be almost inevitable. But what you're talking about here is rehumanizing, getting back into conversation, really connecting human to human as part of online learning.
Yeah, and I think those technologies that could drive dehumanization are in some cases are already driving dehumanization. I think the trick is to understand that any tool can be used in, you know, in many ways. You know, like build a house with a hammer or hit you over the head with it. And so these tools where it might seem like their best and highest use would be to kind of pull all the faculty kind of interaction out of that experience and just fully automate things. That's one way you could use those tools. But what if you just use them to fully automate many of the things and then had a faculty member come back over top of that and say, now that you've been able to do all that on your own, now let's dig into, you know, these interesting, complex other parts that just couldn't be communicated in that way. And let's do that through conversation and through storytelling and through argument. I think we need increasingly advanced technologies to free up more and more of that time when faculty and students are together so that they can do these other things. So I'll keep pushing and driving for those advanced technologies, the same ones that someone else might think of as being dehumanizing. I'll develop them, I'll advocate for them, but always in the context of creating more space for the teacher to have more human interactions, never with a view to cutting that off, just for the sake of increasing efficiency.
Excellent. David, imagine I gave you as much research funding as you wanted. What would you apply? What research would you most like to see?
You know, there are two areas that are quite interesting to me right now that I'm trying to figure out how to bring together. One of them is continuous improvement. And I'm particularly interested in the continuous improvement of instructional resources because in the context of OER, you know, OER, these 5R permissions that I mentioned earlier, OER give us legal permission to change anything about them that we want, but they don't give us any sense of what we should change. Continuous improvement, on the other hand, is a set of practices that we can import from manufacturing or think about where we might bring them from. But continuous improvement typically helps us very quickly kind of identify places in a manufacturing process, for example, where things are going wrong. And where we need to come in and make some very specific changes in order to improve the overall flow of things. The idea that we can take open educational resources, teach with them, collect data about how well they do and don't support student learning, and then use that data to come in and pinpoint, here are the three places that are most in need of help across all the materials that are supporting my course. And then have the permission from OER to actually go in and make some changes to try to create those improvements and then run the course again and see if our changes had their desired effect. I think that whole process of continuous improvement that's enabled really by two things. One, by the permissions that come with OER, and two, by the nature of the data that we're able to collect when learning is happening in a technology-mediated way, whether it's fully online or, you know, whether there's just an online component to what's happening in the classroom. But when you merge that data about what is and isn't working together with permissions to make changes, then you're in a pretty powerful position to go in and make some of those changes and continue teaching over and over again. That's something we've been working pretty explicitly on for 2 or 3 years now at Lumen. And some of our most recent articles, and we have a book chapter coming up here in a couple of months, have all been focused on different ways, you know, devising frameworks and algorithms for asking the kinds of data that come out of an online learning system, hey, data, if I only have, you know, 3 days over the holiday break to make some changes to my class, where are the single highest leverage points, you know, where I could invest that time? So I'm really interested in that work going forward, and we'll keep developing and open sourcing software and publishing open access articles about how to do that and how to make that happen. But I'm also really interested in causal inference and in some of the techniques that are being developed by people like Richard Shinas at Carnegie Mellon or Judea Pearl for doing research that isn't necessarily a randomized controlled trial, but that is still able to make causal claims, even though randomization hasn't happened. As you know, in our context, it's very hard to randomly assign students to classes. Yeah, at the college context. It's very hard to randomly assign faculty to curriculum materials to dictate to them, you know, I flipped a coin and this is the textbook you're going to use this term. Randomization isn't a thing that we're typically able to do in education very often, but some of these causal inference techniques that let us go back through and build models, kind of like path diagrams or like structural equation models, if you're familiar with what those look like, and apply these principles so that we can make causal claims even though we weren't able to randomize. I'm super interested in that. And of course, the thing kind of most exciting to me is about bring those two worlds together. How can I go through the process of making continuous improvements and then apply these causal inference techniques to ask not correlational questions, but ask causal questions about, did the changes that I made to the course, did they cause greater student learning the next semester when it was taught again? Because as soon as I can combine those two things together, then I can create kind of the ultimate virtuous cycle where every semester, every course in my current context here in 2020, every course in the Lumen catalog can be objectively, empirically better every time students take it, because we've been able to go back through with what we call RISE analysis on the front end to identify the parts where we should make improvements. Our instructional designers then made those improvements, and then we're able to use these causal inference techniques on the back end to come in and look and see, did the changes that we made actually cause better student learning? Bringing all that together and then doing it at scale. You know, right now, I think I said a moment ago that in 2019, Lumen supported a little over 250,000 students. That starts to get into the numbers where, you know, you have enough statistical power. The N is large enough that you feel kind of comfortable making some broader claims. If we can keep extending this work out, it just seems like there's really an opportunity to bring a lot of things together. And that's the kind of research that I would want to do. I think we need to establish better frameworks for continuous improvement. We need to establish better frameworks for connecting causal inference techniques into the outputs of that process. And we need a broader, now this isn't research per se, but we need a broader conversation in our field, in the instructional design field, that says, you know, I create something and then people use it, and then I look at the results of that use, and then I improve it, and then I put a new improved thing back out into the world. And it's very much like the transition that software has gone through from like the early days of Blackboard, you know, where you might use Blackboard or WebCT or Moodle, whatever it might be, that you might, you know, you'd download a copy, you'd install it, you'd run it on your campus, and you know, every year, every 18 months, there'd be a new version of Blackboard that would come out and you'd update to that. When you move to a software as a service, a SaaS model like Canvas, hosted Canvas, every day there are bugs being fixed in your Canvas. Every day there, you know, there might be a small new feature that comes out. There are releases and improvements continuously happening rather than happening on these kind of big schedules. And moving instruction materials and learning resources into that world is particularly exciting when we can connect it back and say, look, these improvements, these small things that are continuously being rolled out, really are having some impact on student learning.
So you're talking about a system for evidence-informed practice, continuous improvement based on data evidence. Have you done any proof of concept work on that? It's obviously quite upfront in your thinking at the moment.
Yeah. In 2017, a couple of graduate students and I published a framework paper about how to pull data together to ask the initial question, what parts of the course are in need of most help? And, you know, the kind of thumbnail of that is, well, first, there's an assumption that there's been quite a bit of design that's been done to the course material so that there's a map of learning outcomes that are being covered in the course, and every piece of content and every individual assessment item, whether it's practice or formative or summative in a quiz setting, wherever it might be, each individual item has also been outcome aligned. So that at the end of the semester, I can come back and I can basically make a diagram that plots individual outcomes. Each dot is an outcome. And along the horizontal, I might look at student learning or performance on assessments. And on the vertical, I might look at engagement with resources. And so for any dot, like a dot that would appear right in the middle of that graph, I would have made average use of the resources aligned with that outcome and scored an average score on the assessments that are aligned with that outcome.
Yeah.
So then what we do is we focus in what in that mapping would be the bottom right-hand corner area, which is that learning outcomes where students were very highly engaged with the course content. They were doing the practice. They were, watching the videos or whatever it might have been. They were engaged in a higher than average way with that content, and yet they're performing worse than average on the aligned assessments. That tells you that they're trying, they're in, they're working. But whatever it is that you're inviting them to do in terms of reading, watching, playing, practicing, it's just not working. Mm-hmm. So, we've published a framework paper there. We've published some open source software there that can automate that analysis and generate the visualizations and things like that for people. And my team at Lumen, I have a team that's a smallish team that's focused just specifically, two of them full-time, just on continuous improvement. Yeah. That every month, take the results of, one of these RISE analyses, dig into it, look at the outcomes that it's pointing out as problematic, and then they're making those changes and updating those courses on the fly, and then those changes rolling out. So that first part of it is actually working pretty well. The part that hasn't kind of gotten connected up to that yet is the types of evaluation that we're able to do right now don't rise up to the level of the kinds of claims we will be able to make once we connect these causal inference techniques to the evaluation process. So the front part of it is actually pretty active, and I'm giving a talk about it Thursday morning. It's some of the most exciting work that we're doing, I think, because it really leverages both what's unique about OER and what's unique about online in terms of the kinds of data that can be captured in that context.
Yeah.
Now we just have to make this last step to figuring out how to really evaluate it more rigorously.
Well, we'll certainly link to some of that work on our website. Fascinating. David, can we finish with two people you'd recommend as legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share?
Do you follow Mike Caulfield at all?
No.
So Mike Caulfield does a lot of online learning, and I don't know how he would characterize himself. He was certainly interested in open and was part of the kind of community of people talking about open educational resources and open content and things like that. But a few years ago, kind of in response to things that were happening in the United States, he turned his attention to disinformation. And in the meantime, has created a textbook and created some other resources for teaching students how to fact check, teaching them how to kind of identify and avoid falling into disinformation traps. And I think an interesting point of intersection here is that as we continue to go online for lifelong learning kinds of opportunities after we finish our kind of formal schooling, a lot of the disinformation effort currently seems to be focused in politics. But there's not necessarily any reason to believe that it will stay there. So as people are going out and finding these kind of random, informal learning opportunities with content being provided by, people that we've never heard of before, it does seem like there's some component, some critical thinking component that we need as we become more dependent on sources that send us fewer and fewer signals about their veracity. He's just a totally fascinating guy, first off. And the work that he's doing right now is quite interesting, too. So I think he could be a really interesting person to talk to. Have you ever spoken to Norman Beer at Carnegie Mellon?
No, I haven't.
Norman's work influences mine quite a bit. He is it's kind of the other person that I know who's really interested in continuous improvement and some of these sorts of issues. And his work has certainly influenced mine in that way. He's the head of the Open Learning Initiative at Carnegie Mellon, which is either is actually or is almost 20 years old now, which is a fully online set of courses that are openly licensed. He started before I did on this continuous improvement work, and the kinds of things that he's written and talked about have definitely influenced the way that I've thought about that. So he's a person that's significantly influencing me for sure.
Fantastic. David, thank you for all of the work you're doing, and also for a fascinating interview. I've really appreciated learning more about OER, but also your approach to teaching in an OER context. Also very, very interested in your thoughts around continuous improvement. So thank you for being a leader and legend of online learning.
Thanks for talking with me. This is fun. I appreciate it.
Brilliant.
You can learn more about David and his work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.